right? Even stray dogs and cats do better than horses could do in our
this
world.
This is true.
Right?
This is true.
Can even we survive where we are, let alone the horses? We haven't, as humans, done a very good job of thinking about sustainable living. And but yeah, I think a lot of the solutions, if we were talking about a true crisis type situation of systems fail, the solutions become very local. I guarantee you the governments have emergency preparedness plans, and horses, as big as that industry is, they're part of that plan, right? Mm. We don't.
Welcome to Horse First with Lockie Phillips, a podcast about paying closer attention to the horse, to the work that we do with horses, and paying attention to what's actually happening in front of us. Not what looks good, not what we've been told looks good, because sometimes we slow down and sometimes we speed up, but we don't pretend. I'm Lockie Phillips. Let's begin. Today we are joined by Kim Howard. Kim is a horsewoman and deep thinker who asks some of the biggest questions facing horse people today. Together, Kim and I explore the future of horses, the systems that horses and humans rely upon, and why imagining a better future for horses may be one of the most important responsibilities horse people have. Kim, welcome to the pod.
Welcoming my friend and colleague and longtime collaborator, Kim Howard, back to the podcast. Hello, Kim. How are you today?
Hi, Lockie. I'm doing well. I'm very excited to be back with you. It's always lovely to be with you.
Yeah, always. We're going to get into some slightly difficult territory today. Agreed?
Yes.
This conversation that we've planned, because we like to have chats now about what we want to talk about, especially when my friends return to the podcast for second or third visits. This is your third visit.
Right.
We've been chatting about what's important to us. We've landed on a focus for today. It's a slightly dangerous conversation.
Yes, it is. And I appreciate your willingness to even go here with me.
Yeah, of course. So what we're really here to discuss is the future of horses, specifically the future of horses beyond extraction or systems of extraction.
The potential for that, yes.
Mm. So when I say to you extraction, or for people who work with me regularly and I say extraction around horses, they all nod their heads and understand. But for a lot of people, that word is going to be really abstract and ungrounded in something real. Could you attempt to ground that term, extraction, for us so that someone who's hearing it for the first time in relationship to horses can really understand what we're talking about?
Sure. I mean, I can speak to it in terms of my understanding of it or how I perceive it, right? Because there are different interpretations of that. But for me, it's based in like step back even beyond the horse-human relationship, back from society, and say like humans have been on a path for quite a while now where the domestic systems, the empirical systems that we live within are based on extraction. And capitalism is a big one, right? You often talk about late stage capitalism.
Capitalist hellscape is what I
mean. Yes. Yes. So the horse industry, the horse-human relationship, I think, or at least modern times, has lived within that system. It's part of that system. It always has been part of that system. And things that we have extracted from horses throughout the history started, you know, with war, maybe even started with hunting. Maybe it was meat. Maybe it was food, right? But then war, agriculture, transportation, and then became sport and hobby and you know, now it's even equine therapy, right? And healing with horses. So there's always been this line of there's something we're getting out of the relationship with horses. And that I think it's very hard at this point for humans to even think about our relationship with horses outside of that extractive system. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So we've always been getting something from horses, and there's some debate that horses are getting a lot from us as well.
Sure.
For example, on the other side of that coin, people will say, I don't say, but people do say, well, I feed them, house them, keep them alive, keep them safe. So therefore they serve me by recreation, by work, helping me earn money, helping me relax, helping me have fun. With an equine therapy program, horses step in to help people remove emotional traumas and mental health aspects of their well-being. And horses come in for the sole purpose to aid and abet that process. And then further back in history, they helped us fight wars. And as a result, horses maybe got, I'm stretching, maybe some training, education, and also a whole equitation modality grew up around preparing horses for war that turned into dressage. And a lot of horses benefit from dressage. They live longer lives, healthier lives, sounder lives through that training. A lot of horses' well-beings have been transformed through quality training that arose from cavalry traditions. You know, we can go on and describe how we could say horses have benefited from the human relationship, and in many ways they have. If I had to take a position and not fence it, I would say it's disproportionate. I would say, generally speaking, people have gotten more out of horses than we've given back to them. That's probably the position I would say today.
And my experience from talking to lots of people is that probably most people would agree with that statement. Like that isn't a huge stretch for most people, that horses have given a lot more than they've received in the human horse-human relationship over time. I'm not saying that's true or that isn't true. I'm just saying I don't think that's something I would get a lot of pushback from when I've said something like that. Mm. But there are part of what is keeps systems and empires together is the stories that we tell or that we're told or that we'd internalize, right? So all those examples you just gave are various stories that we tell ourselves and one another about what horses get out of the relationship. And, it's the same as what do people get out of the relationship? There's some commonalities, but there's also what each person gets out of our relationship with horses and with the horses in our lives is a little bit individual and unique.
Yeah. And today's conversation is about the future, stepping beyond extraction, as we've just loosely defined it, and about encouraging anyone who's listening and anyone who's interested to start really thinking about what we're willing to face beyond the systems we've inherited, not so that we can blow everyone's lives up with our conversation today. That's not our point of view or our purpose. Our intention today is not to create anarchy in the horse world. What we're doing is, it's a little bit like being on a ship and being in the eagle's nest with a pair of long distance, what do you call them? These things, periscope, whatever.
Yes.
Right? We're looking on the horizon and thinking, well, what could be all the way over there? And how does that change what we do today? Not to say that that's a definite eventuality, because many things can change between what's on the horizon and when it actually comes for us. Many of us might not even see that in our lifetime, what's on the horizon for the horse world. But it matters that we are willing to look at what's on the horizon. Not so that we can create anarchy now, but so that we can give space and opportunity for people to get aware, and that awareness could lead to change, and those changes could lead to better outcomes for the horses and for the people too. That's the real bit that we're talking about, because we're sort of arguing that systems of extraction aren't really benefiting anybody at this stage. Not really, not on a large scale. And I think, the situation in the world right now has made that really, really clear,
Yes. The time is prime for this type of conversation. And I like to think of it as an exploration. Let's play with these ideas and these hypotheticals, right? Because none of us know what the future is going to be. There isn't any right or wrong answer, but I think it's expansive if we allow ourselves to think about it. And there tends to be a lot of fear, not just in the horse industry, but it is very, I feel it a lot in the horse industry, that there's certain boundaries around which we're just not allowed to go even talk about that, right? Mm. And I think that limits our ability to be creative or to be open-minded about possibilities that nobody is talking about. And we need to be. We should be talking about it, even if it's just as an issue.
We can talk about them. Because here, we're here to pose questions and generate thought. We're not necessarily here to give definitive answers. We couldn't give definitive answers to all of these things. We're here to ask questions and generate thought, start a process, not lead to outcomes. And I would like to see some of these deeper fears potentially shift into a little bit more imagination. Instead of wondering what's wrong, we could wonder what's possible. That's what I'd like to see shift.
That is exactly what I'd like to see shift too. And that's why I wanted to, was up. Interested
do
in having
together.
A conversation. Yeah, yeah. And for you to be able to hold space for that and for the listeners to just, the possibilities.
Yeah. So there is a fear beneath most people's horse ownership. A lot of people don't like that word. If you want to replace the word ownership with stewardship or custodianship or care of, but let's just use the word ownership so we're all just plain speak. Yep. There's a fear that lives underneath horse ownership. And that fear is a lot of people believe that if I die, my horses are vulnerable in the world. And a lot of people even, particularly if they're a certain age or their horses are of a certain age, their plan is if I die, my horse should be euthanized.
Yes.
That's a lot of people's plan. And we were chatting about this. What do you think this reveals?
I think this reveals it's very telling that the system is not designed. There's no safety net, right? We individually and collectively do not feel that there is a safety net for horses in our current world, right? Yes, I can think of one or two people who I might trust to care for my horses the way I do and the way that they need. And I'm going to set up, we talk about the importance of having a plan, having finances set aside in case something happens to you for your horses, right? And I'm all for all this kind of planning because the world currently does not have a safety net for horses, even less than domesticated dogs or cats. Like somebody is likely to take in a stray dog. There are a lot of no-kill rescues, right? There's less risk. I mean, honestly, like what happens to a horse that goes stray, right? And who picks it up, or does anyone pick it up? And if so, where does it go from there, right? We don't have a lot, we don't have a very good plan or systems in place for what happens to horses who are not in the hands of a dedicated caring owner.
Right. And this fear, we're not here today for the whole podcast to discuss the topic of what to do, like what plans to have.
No.
In your will or something for a horse. This is
that
a slightly
could be a whole other, that could be a whole other podcast.
Yeah. Right. Like, one of my close friends recently took me out for lunch and said, could I put you on the will to take care of my horses in the event that I die? I said, 100%. Can I do the same for you? She's like, yeah, 100%. So I've got those agreements, for example. But things can change between here and the other side, and you don't know. So that's a bigger subject. What we're saying is that even people who are deeply invested in the horse world and believe nothing's wrong with it will say often, if I die, my horse should be euthanized because I don't want them to go to anyone else except me. They can't be cared for like I can care for them. And what this is a tell. It reveals that actually we all silently agree that when push comes to shove, we don't trust the very industry that we're a part of. You and I are talking about the horse world. Meanwhile, Kim, we're part of the horse world. We actually don't trust the world that we're in. We don't trust the world that we're in. We don't trust the people to our left. We don't trust the people to our right. Really, when it comes down to it, even the closest friends of ours, we don't know. Like you literally have to be family with someone in order to trust that they might be able to take care of your horses at the level that you do later.
And even then, right? And even
and
then.
And even then, it's a question.
And it's not so it is partly about trust, right? And trusting other people, but it's also, I think, a deeper acknowledgement that systems just don't support it, right? Like even if I I have one friend I have that agree. Actually, I have two friends I have that similar agreement with. I have had 5 to 10 other people ask me that I've had to say no to
no.
Because how many of those can I say yes to, right? If, but obviously they're not all going to come true, but like you still have to, there are limits, right? To anybody's financial resources, land resources, time, energy resources, right? And there are a lot of horses in the world and not a lot of people who are equipped to care for them in the way that we would want horses to be cared for, right? So it's a trust issue, and it's also that the system is
doesn't work.
It's fragile.
Very fragile. The system's very fragile, and many horses are in this dead end system.
Yes.
We're all living in cul-de-sacs.
Right.
Systemically. Right. And not literally, systemically, it means your horse is probably, most horses are probably at the end of their road, right? In most ownership situations. And that doesn't reflect poorly on the individuals who embody that. What we're saying is this is a systemic issue that human beings have built this largely now recreational horse ownership world, not only recreational, but it's largely, that's the majority now. This is considered a recreation worldwide. It's considered a recreation. We've built this without creating the necessary stopgaps, safety nets, pitfalls, eventuality, the support for the actual process of having large animals. We're basically zookeepers. We're private, full-time zookeepers of very large, difficult-to-care-for animals that have a penchant for dying very easily. And we don't have the necessary guardrails to actually make this sustainable in regards to ethical outcomes. I mean, ethical outcomes are extremely expensive, hard to come by. You have to fight for them. You have to fight for them logistically. You have to fight for them culturally, socially, emotionally, financially. You have to fight for ethical outcomes rather than it just being there.
Right. And that comes to, we've made it so much more difficult than it really is. And like, I can already hear all the arguments that come when I say this, and we can work through them. But we have systematically taken away horses' ability to survive and thrive on their own in the current world. Mm-hmm. And that's a huge responsibility, right? Like, yes, it does take a lot to care for horses. It takes a lot to care for horses in the domestic world. And that's not to say that wild living of horses was easy or without dangers or all the things, right? There's many risks there. But a horse that does not have an owner looking out for them in the way that we know where a lot of those horses end up now, really doesn't have any option to survive on its own, right? Even stray dogs and cats do better than horses could do in our
this
world.
This is true.
Right?
This is true. Stray cat colonies can set up somewhere. Stray dog colonies set up somewhere. And I know in Spain, very recently, it became illegal and punishable offense to hurt, harm, or interfere with stray cat colonies. And people go in there and do trap, neuter, release programs. So they trap these colonies, they neuter them, they release them, which allows those cats to live upon the food and shelter resources they're capitalizing on and hold out the breeding and recreation and the overpopulation issues. I've got a cat in my house who came from a trap, neuter, release program, and she was so friendly, she never left. And, you know, we could speak to Brumbies in Australia. We could speak to the Kaimanawas in New Zealand. We could speak to the Mustangs in the United States and so on and so forth. Spain has a few wild populations too. I know other European countries have a few wild populations too. But they're plagued with overpopulation issues. There's a resource use issue. And what you're saying is if a cat is abandoned, many of them have horrible fates. But many of them find themselves in stray colonies or they're able to survive. I've got a stray who lives around my farm. He's been around here for 3 years and he's doing really well and he looks fit and he finds his food and he manages, you know. Yeah. And it's a rough life for him, but he's able to. Could I do the same with my horse if I decided to put them outside my gate? That horse could not. And because they're large, they're logistically difficult to care for. You can't ignore them when they're in a space. They're just there. And so now that we've got this same pet-driven overpopulation issue that cats and dogs experience, without the animals having the freedom and independence to do anything about it on their own, without interference, and without us necessarily managing it very well. And it's created what sort of problems, Kim?
Oh, gosh, all kinds of problems. But before I go into the problems, I will say that there are some pockets of, like, if we look for these, I found out about, I don't remember where it is, I think it's somewhere in Africa, that zebras live wild within these communities. And the communities have agreed that they are sacred beings, so they allow them. I mean, these zebras walk down the road, walk through people's yards, right? And we see this in the Outer Banks in North Carolina sometimes. The horses are in people's yards. So there are some examples of places where the humans have just agreed and there's protections in place, because obviously private property, I don't want horses on my property, right? They're damaging. But there are some models out there, I guess, is where I want to go to possibilities. And I'll also say that with the Mustang situation in the US, I'm not an expert on wild and feral, you know, populations in other areas, but yes, there is an overpopulation potentially, at least that's the story we're told. But the more those of us who have really dug in, the land that was designated for those horses and is protected by the government, now the government leases those lands out to cattle and sheep farmers. And there are literally tens of thousands of cattle and sheep on these lands and 500 horses. And the claim is that the horses are the reason why the land can't sustain it. So some of the stories are not true, right? Because actually wild horses are much easier on land than other livestock animals. So
I'm reading in between your lines there. You're kind of saying, and I've said this before, that if horses were a culturally accepted part of the carnivorous food chain of people, they might experience better outcomes.
Right. And that is one of the fears. I think that we just, you know, and this gets into all kinds of deep things about relationship with death and all of those things, the cycle of life. But yeah, I mean, horses are prey animals in the wild, but they survived for how many millions of years, right? And thrived. Mm. They are well equipped to cope with that when they live naturally and in herds, and they learn from each other how to do that. But yeah, we've taken all that away from them.
From most horses.
Yeah.
Mm. I mean, I'm obviously vegetarian, pescatarian. So anyone listening, I don't eat horses, don't want to eat horses, but I also don't want to eat any mammal at all. And that's just me, right? But I eat fish, and if that makes me a hypocrite, so be it, because the oceans aren't doing any better. But we could get lost to that. That conversation keeps going.
Right.
But what we're saying is that there's limits to our current system, and it's sort of looking a little unsustainable. And we're reaching a moment where we're seeing real cracks in this model. Like what?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely not sustainable along the current trajectory. And it's everything from, I mean, just start with the shortage of large animal veterinarians and people going into that field. The food chain, like all the systems that are so vulnerable, all it takes is, you know, one big weather event, or let's talk about war, politics, right? Climate change and economic stability. We know it to keep horses well is very expensive. We already know that, right? There's already a limit of the number of people, and there's limits on each person's ability to, like, how far can I go with the care that I provide? We all have a cap to that, right? Because of finances. And as economic systems shift and change, if we're heading, I don't know, but if we're heading toward recession in the US, right, there's going to be more and more people, which means more and more horses that fall into that category of not receiving the quality of care. So as systems start to collapse, the suffering on the edges becomes more and more. And we've seen it in pockets, and it could happen worldwide is the point. Like what do we we like to be talking about emergency preparedness, but none of us really want to go there to like, what if this scenario actually happened? What might we be able to do? How could we prepare ourselves and horses for it a little bit more? Mm. And even if it never happens, there could be all kinds of creative solutions to other problems about how many horse owners feel overwhelmed by it. It's all on my shoulders, right? I can't get the help that I need. If there are some more communal shared resource answers that we might look at as solution to a, you know, emergency dire kind of civilization fall situation, maybe that doesn't happen. Hopefully it doesn't, but maybe we can use some of those ideas creatively to solve problems that do arise as the system starts to fail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of uncertainty here. Yeah. And it's important we don't rush to any solutions, but that we also don't shy away from looking at this uncertainty if we're able to. And not everyone's able to or willing to look at this uncertainty. Yeah. Because an hour ago, before jumping on this call with you, I was chatting with someone who is this. Her life came tumbling down. Her system collapsed around her. Now, for her, the system at first was not economic. What collapsed around her was the realization that the system that she was benefiting from, she was an instructor and a trainer. And okay. realized that the way she was training and the way she was instructing was inherently antagonistic, violent, and harmful towards the horses. She realized that. And yep. upon that realization, once she realized that and it really landed and she didn't shy away from the truth of that and had that confirmed for her through her own horses over and over again, she looked at her fully booked schedule, all her clients and all her horses and realized, oh my God, I've built this. And now I realize I built a house of horrors.
And I'm stuck in it.
Yeah. And I'm stuck. And so it all came crashing down because she didn't have the safety net to make a transition immediately. She didn't have the clientele. She didn't have the right marketing and positioning to bring in a different type of clientele that would look for different types of solutions, because right now her very clientele were keeping her stuck in the systems and solutions she was providing. Her clients wanted that from her, wanted yeah. harmful solutions. So her clients were keeping her stuck on harmful solutions. And I can feel there are so many people listening, nodding their heads right now, thinking, that is me, that is me, that is me. My clients yeah. are keeping me held against the need to give them solutions I know are harmful to the horses, but make the person feel great. This is real talk now. And so this person very calmly said, I had to sell horses. Mm-hmm. I had to stop teaching. I had to sell my home. And now I'm essentially homeless, They're okay. They're safe. They have a living situation, but they're essentially homeless. They kept one horse. And now they don't know what to do, and they just said, help. Now, in that situation, they were lucky in the sense that they were able to redistribute the horses they sold within the community. So that's lucky. I hope those horses ended up in places where they'll be all right, you know? Yeah. And obviously they hope that too. But there's a limit to the amount of redistribution that someone like that could experience if every trainer in the world realized that their system was built as a house of horrors. Where would all their horses go? Where would the up-down lesson bar? What would they do if they realized that all their up-down lesson horses were sore-backed and sour? What would they do? What would they do if the very clients that were paying those horses' feed bills stopped coming? What would they do? There's no guardrails in place. And so that's just one example that happened to me an hour ago. So this is not something that's necessarily far off in the future in a microcosm way, and maybe even on a larger scale. It's kind of happening now to many people.
It is happening now, or there's many people who are like one small little thing away.
One bad month. Or away from selling the horses.
Or they're just trapped in the system. And then what does that do to your, like, if she had decided, I just have to keep doing this to financially survive, what does that do to you? your mental health, your spiritual health, your, and anyway, it's a, yeah, I mean, these problems are so huge. It's amazing that we don't talk about them, but it's almost like, it's just too much to look at. It's just too big.
But the
truth is, I don't think it is too big to look at. And I think, as I said, there are some pockets of models out there of some other ideas, but you know, it has to be collective conversations. There have to be more of us talking about it and being concerned about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You said something earlier, a moment ago, that I'd just like to reiterate. You said we could be looking at other examples of people who prepare for system collapse. Not to replicate exactly, because they're doing it in different fields and in different ways.
Right.
But actually to learn from the way they're preparing and see what we could adapt in the horse world as a way just to build security in our communities and build security for horses. So, for example, let's put it really simple. Doomsday preppers who build bunkers, and, you know, there are fun shows on Bravo about people who build bunkers, and it's all kind of cute to think about it. But these people are very sincere and serious. You know, they're stockpiling food and water and spending millions on these doomsday scenarios. And then on a smaller scale, you've got extreme couponers who have whole rooms in their house full of laundry detergent, just in case laundry detergent, you know, and the way people at during the pandemic ran to the supermarket to buy toilet paper. And
well, that's that's the, like, hoarding and preparation. Like, I think that's not sustainable either, to be honest with you, but it is the inclination.
Yeah, so that's kind of an unsustainable capitalistic version of it. But for example, to speak on myself, I relocated across a country. I mean, I've relocated many, many times, but I've chosen where I want to live for now. And I chose this region not because it's glamorous to live here, and not because everyone in the world wants to live in this region, and because it's, you know, the metropolis of Madrid and the accessibility to, like, the heartbeat of society in Spain, and not because it's the romance of Andalusia or whatever. I chose this region because hay grows here abundantly and cheaply. And I chose this region because it's a climate haven where climate change is happening slowly. And I chose this region because though it rains a lot in winter, which keeps the property prices low, which is another reason why I bought it, because I could actually afford property here.
Yep.
The rain keeps property prices low, which feeds my lower hay bill, feeds my pasture, my grass grows, and my house is cheap, and my water bills are, for four horses and me, my water bills annually are 50 euros.
Yeah.
Annually for municipal water.
Yeah. And I have zero water costs, but I have a well. And if there's a drought enough, the well could potentially go dry. But
also have a well that I was like, my gardener was like, should we connect it? Should we not? So I could get that 50 euros knocked off if I wanted to. And so I moved to this region for that reason, and then discovered I've got a neighbor that's got a warehouse with at least 2,000 round bales that he doesn't know what to do with.
Wow.
Of organic grass hay. He's like, how many do you want? I'm like, can I have 70 a year? He's like, sure. Do you want 1,000? Like, what are we going to do? And they're 25 euros each. It's obnoxiously cheap to buy that. But that's why I moved here. So that's my doomsday prepping version.
Yes. So you just said one thing we could all do better, right? That's one thing, is if we want to have horses in our life, could we make a conscious decision about where are we keeping them? Where we're keeping them, where we're living, why we're making those choices, all of those things. Most of us don't. We live somewhere and we decide
that's where you live.
Horses into our, right? So even that would be beautiful to be able to think about, right? And if we thought about something happened and our horses needed to be set free for a little while or survive on their own, right? Like, how far away are you from drinkable water? Right. Because even as much as food, it's like, is there water access, natural water access that horses could and humans could survive on? Right. We we ourselves live in places that are probably not very inhabitable if systems break down. Right. If there's no electricity, if there's even just that. Right. If we just took that, can even we survive where we are, let alone the horses? We haven't, as humans, done a very good job of thinking about sustainable living. And but yeah, I think a lot of the solutions, if we were talking about a true crisis type situation of systems fail, the solutions become very local.
Mm.
And it's not about hoarding, because that's only a temporary solution anyway, and probably creates competition. And people are like, then it's, oh, how do I protect what I have from people who want to come get it? That's a whole dynamic. It's about how do we come together to solve problems together, right? For ourselves, for horses. It becomes communal and community and relationship and land resource based. And what can the land here sustain? And do we need to move somewhere else? Do we need to travel? You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. And I'm actually living that. Like, for a lot of folks, that might sound like a pie in the sky, tree hugger, hippie thing to be talking about. But I want people to know this is what happens in my local community, right? And this is not the first place in this country I've experienced this. There is a coppice, which is a fancy word for a forest that's farmed wood, right? So it looks like a forest, but when you look closely, all the trees are in a line everywhere. So it's been farmed for hundreds of years, yes? Mm-hmm. This forest is owned by the local community, and it's a couple of hundred hectares. You can go trail riding in it. It's actually really gorgeous. And there's a mixture of eucalyptus and pine and oak and ash. It's a whole thing.
Yep.
This is owned and managed by a local forestry community, which is the unofficial local political association. Like, there's the mayor, but really he's a figurehead. Really, the whole community is run by the forestry association.
Interesting.
And by a few local families and individuals that are considered figureheads of the forestry association. If you've lived in this area for a minimum of 2 years, you're invited to join. My neighbor kept pestering me to join. They could have excluded me so easily. Kept pestering me to join, and I finally joined. You have to write a letter. I would request to please join the forestry community. And they sit down in a meeting and, are we going to accept this person into our community? Yes, we will. He brought a letter over to my house. He said, this is a very important letter. And the letter in Spanish says, my name, my information is accepted as part of the local community. His property and his house is now considered a community house, which means if there is an emergency in our community, your property can and will be called on to help and support. There's a flood down the road and someone needs somewhere to be. My house has to be an open house. It's actually like an open house agreement that I open my house and my property to the community was there a crisis. This is all written down. And
Actually,
it's beautiful. And this has been here for hundreds of years. And the agreement is that if I want to, I can go to the meetings and I can vote on local municipal matters. Should we plant 30,000 pine trees this year or 20,000? Should we go for this distributor or that distributor? Should we cut this section or that section? And they cut sections of the forest each year. They sell the wood off and you get about 600 euros each a year, which pays for my property taxes, for example. Mm-hmm. And so there's that. And then you're allowed, it says on it, you're allowed to use that forest to graze your animals. So if I wanted to, I could shepherd my horses down the road and I could turn them out in the forest and I'm permitted to be there to feed my animals. Now, I ain't got time for that, but if shit really hit the fan, I'm allowed to.
That is a beautiful example, Lockie, right? Of a community that actually has thought ahead to what would happen and how would we respond to it. And there's some sort of agreement, right? At least in writing. I mean, there might be squabbles when it came to push comes to shove, the implementation, but there is a generalized agreement. And yeah, I think that's exactly the kind of thing we ought to be thinking about. It might never happen, but if it does, private property is one of the biggest obstacles, right? Of being able to say we can't share these land resources or natural resources that are available, that if our human systems, our domesticated systems fall apart, we have to turn to natural resources.
Yeah. Right. And the region I live in is considered depopulated. Okay. And they're trying to bring people back. So it's an underpopulated region, but when I was moving in and I was looking to what I could build for my horses, there were enormous restrictions placed because it's considered an area of cultural heritage because of all the old buildings here. And it means that this environment will look exactly the same in 15 years with very little change. no one is ever going to be able to buy the plot next door and build on it because it's an unbuildable plot. You cannot build on it. And that will never change in this country, promise you. The Spanish won't shift on that. Yeah. And no one who has a buildable plot next to me can build something on my perimeter because it's forbidden to put something. So overpopulation here is forbidden at a legislative level because they're culturally preserving what's already here. They kind of said, this is the limit to what is sustainable for the yep. area and that has been here for thousands of years. This is a Roman, there's a Roman ruin 10 minutes from my house. So people have been here for thousands of years. They kind of know what the land can and can't do for people. And there are examples of that in Western society where this is actually functioning
yes.
and working.
And so we could take those concepts, those ideas, and as a horse community, we could bring, or even just to bring horses into those community conversations. Although I think if local communities are having those conversations or regions and there's horses in those communities and regions, it will be part of the conversation.
Right.
But we as a horse community, horse industry, could start pushing those conversations differently. Because if we love horses as much as we say we do, don't we want to have more of a safety net for them
right.
than currently exists? I think right. we do.
Right.
And I think we all spend more time maybe subconsciously worrying about that than we even know.
Mm-hmm.
Stressed. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think another part of this is that when we're looking for solutions, or if not solutions, we're looking for alternative systems, we're looking for even the right questions to ask. Sometimes we know there's a problem, but we don't know what questions should I ask about my problem to move the needle. So for example, someone living out in California where horses are living in rows and rows of chicken coops, and there's 100 horses on a 1 acre plot or some crazy stuff that you see in some states in the United States. You do see that in the United States.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Right. Which is from an ecological standpoint unsustainable. From a species standpoint, it's unsustainable. And from an equitation standpoint, it doesn't make any sense because there's no scenario in which these horses are long-term sound. But I digress.
It's not working for anyone. And yet,
not working for no one. Right. And not well, it's working for some local businesses that are able to make an income off it just for a period of time, but long-term they struggle. They struggle, and this breeds all sorts of problems in community. Stressed out boarding barn owners do not become nice people to deal with very quickly.
No.
And then they don't create nice communities, and then because they're stressed out just by pure financial stress. And so if they're not commanding and leading healthy pockets of communities around their business, then people step in and step out and go off on these individual tangents where they're making these individual stabs in the dark decision about where should I keep horses? How many horses should I have? How should I do it? And then so everyone's trying to make it up on their own rather than sort of crowdsourcing these problems, because at a legislative level, not every country has kind of got it together the way Spain has. Not that Spain's perfect. There are plenty of problems here too. And people step around the legislation all the time. But yeah, I think when we're looking for the right questions to ask, because we might be on our own, we might feel cast out, we can actually look to horses as yes. teachers of what the future system could look like, right?
Yes. And one of the main ways about that is that if you look at all the places that wild living horses lived, horses are incredibly adaptable. They can survive in a lot of different kinds of environments and can even thrive in a lot of different kinds of environments. So this is where I get to each solution doesn't have to look the same. There's not any one right way to create communal living for horses that they can thrive in, right? There are different models of that. And so there's some creativity that we should be open to there. And the other thing is, I do think it has to be, and this is what I hope, maybe we plant a seed with this conversation, is to have more people talking about this. And because if we don't acknowledge that there's a big, big problem, right, then what happens is everybody's sort of like, if you broach, oh, maybe we should talk about combining, you know, how could we create communal living here? And it's kind of like, oh, no, I'm good. I've got my situation. Right. There's a very protectivism about like, I'm okay right where I am. I'm not open to a broader conversation about how do we share, how do we make this better for everyone, right?
And also a bit of societal exhaustion. People are kind of exhausted by other people also.
Right. Yeah. And that's a problem too, right? Mm. There's so many layers to the challenges, but I don't like, I like focusing sometimes on the potential and the possibilities.
That's right.
Because we got to have that motivation to what we think we, you know, there are some really cool possibilities here if we can get past these obstacles of being too afraid or too tired or too whatever to talk about it. They're not going to happen magically. The system is designed to perpetuate itself, right? Unless the system just crashes and falls, which, you know, I'm not saying it isn't going to happen at some point in our lifetime or later, but the more we've had some of these conversations, the more prepared we are to then go after this big rupture. How do we repair and do it differently and better?
Yeah.
Like next time, right?
Yeah. Yeah. What we're not advocating is that people take their horses and throw them out on the street and say, go be free. Because you know, within about 20 minutes, an army of Shetland ponies are going to show up at a corn factory, like with knives to everyone's throat, like hand it over, you know.
We just started this conversation by saying there is no safety net. There is no public safety net for horses. So no, none of us, it drives me crazy when I start talking about some open-mindedness about thinking about things and people go immediately to, well, that's just crazy. I can't let our horses go. No, we can't. It's a problem too, right?
That we can't.
It's a problem that we can't, or that there's no process. There's just no safety net, right? For these animals that we love so much and that we work so hard to protect and provide good as well as we can for them, right? Mm. But we know that take you out of the, not you have a safety net, but we all know that take the person who loves those horses most and is most committed to them out of the picture, and it becomes risky for that horse real fast.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the bottom line.
Mm-hmm. 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 And what we're trying to do is to shift from fear into a possibility, because horse social structures function through cooperation, through accountability, through shared leadership, and non-dominance-based organization. And when we use the word dominance, let me bookmark that I'm just going to tangentially like address dominance a little bit, because I've contributed quite a lot of time and energy and resources to the non-dominance debate for a while. And then I shied away from it because I went, hang on a minute. What I'm seeing in horses does not necessarily align with the rhetoric around, well, dominance theory is dead. And that's still true. Dominance theory is according to this singular, monolithic, limited definition of dominance, which was there's an alpha and then everyone that goes underneath. So
right.
It's a top-down hierarchical structure that's rigid and fixed. One being is superior and everyone else follows. That was the original notion of dominance. That idea of dominance as it pertains to horses is debunked.
Correct.
But to deny that social dominance through a different and more flexible and adaptable definition doesn't exist is a little bit like denying gravity exists, because of course there are situations where one being takes the lead over others, but that is non-hierarchical in healthy horse societies and free horse societies. It's non-hierarchical and it's not fixed. So individuals will take turns in who is asserting a social dominance right now. I'm taking the lead right now. And it's not always because they're in front. Sometimes the one taking the lead is off to the side, drawing everyone else in a different direction, or from behind, pushing from behind, or in the middle of asking everyone to drop their energy and go calm. So leadership is not this, I'm out in front, everyone follow, I'm at the top, everyone's under. Yeah. It can be that, but it can also be many other things. The opposite of dominance is not anarchy. The opposite of dominance, according to the old definition, is actually a fully integrated everything, right? And so So that's what we're offering, is not this one singular solution to the lack of safety nets we have for horses. What we're actually asking for is a totally integrated everything. You got an option? Integrate it. You got another option? Try integrating that too. You got another idea? Yeah, give it a go. Give it a go. Like that's the energy of the doomsday preppers. Like, I'm going to leave no stone unturned. So how can we take that and use that in a way that might be applicable in our scenario, to have a non-dominance-based organization, hierarchical? Instead of hierarchical, we would have horizontal relationships to each other, where, what do you think? What do you think? What about this person? What's behind me? What's aside? What am I missing? You know? What,
exactly. Yeah. And, you know, we think about how much time, and I've been as guilty of it as anyone. We get on our thing about, oh, you know, anti-slaughter or anti-kill pens, or like, we spend so much time talking about these, pushing against these problems, but we aren't doing the work as communities to come up with other solutions, right? There are possible options. And we just try to stick it in the same model of, there's more horses than there are good homes that can afford to take good care of them and have the space to take good care of them, right? We're just stuck in that model of being like, no, there are a gazillion other probably possibilities that we're not even considering.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, even at scale. I have been very blessed and lucky to have been invited by one of the largest equine rescues in the United States, one of. It's a multi-million dollar operation. It's an eight-figure operation annually. They rescue hundreds of horses a year. They've got many horses who are in permanent accommodations with them for the rest of their lives. And they have a really robust rehoming program. They've got dozens and dozens and dozens of employees. Not unlimited resources, but this is an organization that's got, you know, millions at their disposal annually to actually try the rescue, rehome, and redistribution model in the United States to address the slaughter pipeline issue, to address the industry wastage issue, to address the old throwaway horse issue. They've really looked at it at scale. And in conversations with the people who invited me, who are actually at a managerial level, at this organization, because I presented a clinic there, in conversations, they do an amazing job, and they're very successful and have been for a long time at rehoming hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of horses. And there's a limit to the number of homes that they can find.
And like I was going to say, how much has that huge operation and all the good work that they're doing, how much has it moved the needle overall?
Right.
In the larger problem.
Right, right. Thankfully, they've saved the lives of hundreds of horses, and there are still thousands of horses to be saved. So,
and that that cycle is just
that'll keep going, right.
And so going back to systems thinking, we've got to get to systems thinking. The system is not working; it's not sustainable. It will crash at some point, right? Maybe not in our lifetime. So it's easy to say, we just hold the line, you know, hold the line for now.
You know, Kim, when you say not in our lifetime, it will crash at some point, what I think is happening is that the crash is happening now. It's just in slow motion. Yeah. And so it's not like a overnight thing or something that happens one summer where it all suddenly comes to a head. At an individual microcosm scale, I told the story of the person I spoke to now an hour and a half ago, where for them it did, like one summer, all come tumbling down. So at an individual level, there will be thousands of examples of people suddenly today, it's like, oh, suddenly this month or suddenly this season, my whole life changed and came crumbling down. So at a micro scale, yes, it happened suddenly. On the broader scale, the system is in a slow motion collapse that is happening over 20, 30, 40, 60, 80, maybe even 100-year period. And I think not all of us are going to see the end of the collapse, but a lot of us we're all witness to it happening in real time. And I think we're in the middle of it in many respects. Not everyone's bearing witness to it, because there still remains in the horse world a lot of wealth, a lot of privilege, a lot of people who are safely accommodated. They've got their land. They don't see it. They're out of sight, out of mind. But you know, as a service provider, I've got my boots on the ground often at the front lines, and I'm seeing it, and so are you in your capacity. And frankly, you were the first person I found who was actually discussing this issue at a high level. And the first time you started discussing it, and the notion, the hint, the inference that open the gates, would you set your horses free if it was safe to do so, was really tough for me to hear as someone who loves having horses under my window. You basically said, if it was safe for your horses to do so, totally safe. You knew that not only would they be fine, they might even do better if you opened the gate and let them go. Would you do it? You were the first person to ask that question. And that's a on the horizon question for horse ownership as a thing in human society. I don't think that's something we're going to face in my lifetime.
Right.
But at the first moment I went, oh, that's hard for me to hear. And then I went, great, lean into that. Understand what that trigger, quote unquote, trigger is for me. And really think to myself, what could I learn from that experience? What could I learn about having horses under my window? What could I learn about how do I change the way I keep them if I had the belief that if I could, boys, I would open the gate and let you go? How would I be different as a trainer, as an instructor, as a horse person, if I believed that one day I might be able to open the gate and let horses free? How would that change? Because the next bit I want to talk to you about is the importance that horse people engage with this system's collapse. Because if horse people don't adequately, robustly engage with our own system and the way it's dysfunctional and unsustainable, a few risky things happen. And they are happening right now in real time. Others are going to step in and do it for us if we don't.
Of course.
Who will they be? What sort of people, what sort of outside influences would step into the horse world to regulate an unregulated system?
I mean, I don't even know off the top of my head necessarily, but if you're suddenly dealing with a lot of starving horses, a lot of people who just do open the gate because I don't know what else to do,
then right.
Those horses... there aren't a lot of legal, at least here in the U.S., legal, you know, they'll just get picked up and slaughtered, or people would start hunting them, or there'd be some way they would become a nuisance, and it would get dealt with however nuisances get dealt with, right? And, or if there's some use that we could find for them, might not be good, might be even worse for horses. They might be put to some sort of a use. I don't know what that would be right now, but like we would extract, the powers that be would figure out some extractive way to either get rid of the problem or put to some other use. Correct.
Yeah. Melt them down for glue, turn them into dog food, hunt them for the food chain. Also, let's look at animal activist groups. PETA, for example. PETA, which is a very wealthy, powerful, established organization. They're no longer fringe or they're considered extremists by certain people, but actually they have a mainstream foothold.
They were cutting edge, yeah. I mean, you know, something about whatever about how you feel about their tactics, right?
Yeah.
They were cutting edge.
They're cutting edge. And now at this point, they're an established organization. They do have contacts, arms, and integrations at a political level in every country. They do. They have lobbyists and advocates, and they're well connected, and they're organized, and they're passionate. And if you spend 10 minutes on their website or on their social media and look at what they're planning for the horse world, it's essentially our erasure. That's what they're planning for us. And they're powerful, they're passionate, they're organized, they're focused, they're getting their stuff together. And if we don't start taking care of it, they might get to a critical mass of organization where they've done it for us and they pull the rug out from underneath our feet.
My big question around that is so if they have this plan, which I haven't looked at their website, I should, what is their plan for what happens to all the horses?
I don't actually know exactly what their platform is. I should probably look at that before I invoke it. I spent 10 minutes on their website once just to put my finger to the wind, just to take their pulse. What are they thinking about the horse world right now? And at a superficial level, means I'm not looking at it deeply. What I'm seeing is what's the immediate clear image they want people to hear.
Yeah.
Right.
And they want immediate horses to stop. Reuse and ownership of horses.
They want ownership and riding of horses to stop. Right. Period.
My question is, have they even gone as far as what's next? Like, that's
one. Yeah.
Have so I'm like, maybe there's some creative thoughts there that the rest of us could use in a way. My guess is they haven't gotten there. They're just too busy on the fight of what they don't want. Mm. Right. What is beyond all of that?
Right.
That's plain chess. Yes, yes, yes. We got to get past just the dead ends.
We keep
getting stuck with is like, what do we all want ultimately? Is not worth it to survive and thrive, right? Hopefully that's what we all want, regardless of the different scenarios. And there could be lots of, we know horses can survive and thrive in the domestic world. Horses can survive and thrive in the wild, right? They're very, very adaptable animals. There's got to be. Well, and we are too, but we forget.
We're supposed to be. I think we forget that we're
adaptable. I think humans and horses are two of the most adaptable species on the planet, personally, but I think we don't lean into that very much. And we don't work on our own resiliency and the abilities to be adaptable, and we don't work on that with horses either. So there's things we could, anyway, I think that there's lots of probably terrain between how do horses thrive in a domestic setting and how do horses thrive in the wild. There are many, many tentacles and options in between there that nobody's exploring because we're just stuck in the this or that, right? Or it's that.
I think it's so important that horse people are willing and able to engage with the problems in our system.
Yeah.
And to remove blockades and blockages towards systems change, because there's a lot of gatekeeping, there's a lot of stonewalling that happens, there's a lot of protecting of assets removing of progress. You know, you try to shift something here and then they stonewall you, they don't reply to your email, you never get a call back. There's a lot of that going, kind of head in the sand, wanting it to go away and things to carry on the way they've always been. And they can't, they won't. And, you know, some people are going to be able to outrun the collapse for a long time, for a few generations, but it's going to catch up with everyone. As per usual, the biggest driver of change is going to be from the grassroots up, as per usual, not from the top down. So we can't look necessarily at the people who already hold the power and the resources and the land and the horses and the communities and galvanized businesses. We can't necessarily look at them to be the leaders in this because they've got a vested interest to keep things the way they are. We need to look at people who are already facing the cusp of collapse. They're the ones who are actually most likely to lead the change because they kind of have no choice now, kind of coerced.
They're motivated. They're physically motivated to think about creative solutions. Yes, that's probably where these conversations need to be happening. And not just within the horse community, although we can start it, but then who else do we need to bring in to those conversations to have community solutions? Like I said, I don't think the solutions are going to look the same in every local environment, right? The solutions are going to have to look somewhat different, but let's come up with 10 possible scenarios that could work well. And then how do we play with those? Right. But again, if we're just too busy expending the trying to keep the status quo, trying to make it work, especially those who are so struggling. I mean, I talk to a lot of clients who are really struggling with what do I do with my horses? Can I keep them? How do I rehome them? Like, there's a lot of stress out there around that.
And a lot of businesses are one drought riddled harvest away from being unable to feed their barn.
Totally.
They're already in that problem. You know, so horse people, we kind of have to wake up a little, you know, just gently offering, wake up everyone and start to engage in this, not through fear, but through imagination. And don't cloister ourselves into this conversation, because if we cloister ourselves, we've got a track record of being unable to get ourselves out of our own mess. We've got a track record at that. We need to be able to reach outside of our own world and speak to ecologists, speak to environmentalists, speak to animal activists, speak to lobbyists and politicians and people who move the needle around us and say, well, what are you guys thinking outside looking in? What do you think we need? And what are your plans? And well, we're horse people, so we understand the relationship between horses and people. And that's got to come into factor when we look at these systems changes. You've got to respect the relationship between horses and people that we've had for 5 millennia. We can't abandon that. We can't erase that. We've got to respect that relationship. We've just got to put guardrails in place. We understand what horses need to be healthy and happy, especially horses that have been far removed from their ability to survive on their own. We need to be the ones saying, well, there are some horses that you can take over here and they'll survive and some that can't. And what are we going to do? And we bring in the nuance of being on the ground with horses every day. We've got to engage with this, because if we don't, then the legislation that will come down the pipeline will exclude us rather than include us. And I'm not being alarmist, because I've lived through myself actual events that let me know that this is a legislative possibility. Like, I think I've told this story before, so forgive me if I'm repeating myself, but during COVID, Spain overnight issued a decree that all what was considered extreme sports were now illegal, including, and they targeted the equestrian community, horseback riding and equestrian horse-related activities, specifically riding, is right now illegal unless you are a federated rider with the Spanish Equestrian Federation, meaning you have to ride to make a living, and then you're paying money into the federation. And very few people are paid into the federation in Spain, very few. So unless you're running a breeding yard where developing horses for sale is actually your job and you're registered as doing that, you're allowed to ride. If you're an agriculturalist and you ride animals to take care of your livestock somewhere, you're allowed to do that if you're registered as that activity. If you are a privately owning horse person that rides them without paperwork and you are caught, it is a 600 euro on the spot fine, because you are putting the medical system at risk if you were to fall, and we need to preserve our medical system. So somewhere in my mind, it was installed in the back of my mind that though it doesn't happen and most of the time it sits there benign, the Spanish government actually can and will and has the power to overnight immediately make the thing I love the most illegal. That if push comes to shove, they have that power, they have that attention. We're not under the radar, we're actually on the radar. There's historical precedence here. These things can and will happen if the right conditions call for it.
I guarantee you the governments have emergency preparedness plans, and horses, as big as that industry is, they're part of that plan, right? Mm. We don't necessarily know what it is. Think about if there ever becomes a communicable disease that can be transferred between people and horses. I mean, bingo, bam, right? And what have we, so we talk about training horses and, you know, building them to be able to cope and do so, will thrive in all the domestic pursuits, right? But what if we also had a focus on prepping horses to be able to live without us if they had to, for even 6 months in a time of quarantine, whatever, right? Like, do we even think about our responsibility of owners of prepping horses for that, versus just training them to be good at all the things we want them to be good at in our current world, right? So yeah, these conversations are like, oh wow, you know, we're just not thinking.
We're not there.
We're not thinking about it.
We're not thinking beyond our next ride, and that's a big problem. Again, this has happened in Spain. I'm not a historian, and I haven't studied it in depth. This is my horseman's understanding of what happened. I think it was in the 90s or in the noughties, 20, 30 years ago, somewhere along those lines. African horse sickness jumped across the Mediterranean and entered the horse population, starting in Andalusia and then spread across the country. Wow. And ever since then, the movement of horses across Spain is now extremely strictly regulated, to the point where it's an absolute paperwork nightmare to take a horse anywhere. Ask me how I know, because I've moved horses around more times than I care to admit. Particularly in the south of Spain, Andalusia is incredibly difficult to move horses around. To move a horse from one property to the next legally requires a paperwork process that takes at least a week.
Wow.
You have to get a special paper, and your horse, to get that paper, to get that guía de traslado, to get that paper, your horse has to be registered with a microchip, and that microchip is registered with its breed association. And then you have to be registered with like a REGA number, which is like a property number, and that property has to be inspected by a vet to make sure it's meeting municipal regulations. And some properties require you to have a concrete chip pit and a contract for manure removal, and the properties are heavily regulated. And you also have to register that horse with like a pet ownership system in the country. So you've got to register the horse across like 4 or 5 different governmental departments, and then go to your local agricultural office. And depending where you are, sometimes the vet that gives you the paperwork is working, and sometimes he's having a nap under a tree after a siesta. So you've got to find the damn vet, and you've got to make sure you've got all your paperwork in place. And if your paperwork's not in place, you've got to find the vet that can do the paperwork for you so you can get the paperwork to move the horse. Now, that's a movement within the state. And you have to get that paperwork just even to take the horse to a competition. And that's within the state. If you're taking a horse outside of the state, you have to get that same paperwork. But now your state official at your municipal office has to call the state official in your next municipality on the other side of the country and say, he wants to bring the horses into your community. Is that permissible? Yes or no? They have to call, and you have to get approval on the other side of the country before you shift them. And you're not allowed to put them on the trailer before you get that paperwork. It's so tightly controlled, because the idea is the government knows where every horse is at every given time. Now, the reality of that is many people have it as a paperwork exercise, and horses are living hither and thither all over the country. Yeah. Whether they live where they're registered or not is another story, right?
People will always find ways around the systems, yeah.
They'll always find ways around the system. And my vet here in the northwest of Spain, further away from Africa, was part of the task force that sought to deregulate some of these regulations, because he's like, it's impossible for my clients to actually like have business and run commerce and move horses around. We've got to make it a little easier, at least in this state, to move horses around. But in the south of Spain, they're still operating as if African horse sickness is right around the corner.
Yeah. And I mean, some new disease could come out tomorrow, right?
Right. Like,
these things can, and again, we don't have control over all those things necessarily, but the extent to which we just kind of blindly assume, like here in the US, you know, sometimes there's a little bit of paperwork to cross state borders, but a lot of times not even that. Like, we can transport horses. If you have a Coggins, you can transport horses, right? Mm-hmm. Now, certain places might have regulations about vaccination to be able to enter in or whatever, but we just take for granted a lot of the things that are really easy about that. So I think this comes back to largely what that example you gave about the forestry thing there, and the community having a plan, right? The local community having a plan. Like, that feels to me like something that is a really cool place to start, right? For any of us, because most types of emergencies and scenarios, now like a national or international pandemic or epidemic, that's going to create a whole different scenario. But a lot of things could come down to, you know, even if we just had 6 or 7 big horse farms here that were designated as the place people could bring horses.
Right? In an emergency.
In an emergency, either temporarily or whatever, like just
in
like
a death.
Exactly.
A local horse person dies, there is a local farm that keeps enough feed and enough paddock that those horses could be transported by officials onto that farm. There's a certain stipend available to them at a municipal level. I mean, there are ways that this can be done. Yeah.
Volunteers can. I mean, there's tons of people. As a business that serves both horse people and non-horse people, I can tell you there are a lot of non-horse owners who love horses, who volunteer, like, you know, to do some of the tasks, even if they weren't direct hands-on care, just to know they were part of a safety net for this amazing species. Like, humans, we have a love affair with horses. Mm. There aren't very many people you meet, unless they've just had a horrible fear experience. And sometimes even then they're like, I love horses, but I'm scared of them.
Right.
Right. There aren't too many people that hate horses. I don't come across too many.
Some people hate them. A lot of people respect them through fear or are intimidated by them, but think they're beautiful.
Yeah. Hardly anybody thinks horses are evil or bad or shouldn't be here. Like, that's just, I think the biggest capital we have is that there is a great love for horses.
And that's what we need to lean into, because, you know, what this conversation has been all about is what would happen if we stopped assuming incorrectly that the future is going to look like the present.
Right.
Not to catastrophize, but to wonder what is possible now. And what if the possibility is less, I'm on my own danger, my horses are dangerous without me, and more, I'm in a community where my horses are safe with or without me. What if that's what the future could be? And it will be that if we engage with this process. If we disengage with this process, it's not going to be that.
Right. I would love to leave it, like we could even leave it there to just say for today, if you can just sit and in your body, what does that feel like? If you could say, I know, regardless of what happens to me, there is a safety net in place for my horses.
Yeah.
How would that feel in your body? And like, let's go for that. Let's go for creating that.
Yeah. And the kind of safety net we're talking about is a practical one. It's not across the fingers, I trust something will come out of the blue sky to save me. It's there is funds, there are people, there is resources available for me and my horses in the eventuality that I couldn't, or that there was a collapse, or that there was a change, or that if I had a bad month or whatever, so that I can stay in the horse and equestrian lifestyle.
Yeah.
And with more security.
The other piece I think is that this solution is not just a human solution. The horses need to be part of it, because the bottom line is that a lot of horses can be more self-sufficient than we give them credit for. Not all. Like, again, this isn't like a black or white conversation, but to be able, there might be tiered solutions to say, horses that could do this, we would do this with. Horses that can't, we'd get this. And like, right? So acknowledging that we have to look at today's horses and what are the options available within the spectrum of today's horses. They need to be part. They need to bring their abilities and capabilities to the solution as well.
That's right. You know, I'm going to finish on this story. It's an anecdote, which is an example of this solution. A very good friend of mine, went through a divorce, which is an example of a systems collapse, right?
Totally.
And it's an example of one of the most common reasons why horses are rehomed, moved on. They end up on the river again. Yep. They had two horses, and one of the horses, a mare, belonged to her husband, and she never really got along with the mare very well. Loved her, of course, worked with her, but she could tell that the mare wasn't really happy in the system. Her gelding, she knew he was thrilled with the system, loved the system, would suffer without the system that she was offering him.
Yep.
And then through the divorce, made the decision to keep the gelding close, because of course there's a financial restriction now on what the future can give her and the horses, and decided to find a retirement situation for the mare. Found a situation in a different country where someone who was able to buy land and lots of it and had the desire set up a sanctuary for people to retire their horses or to send their horses. And they took their horse to this place where there's dozens and dozens of horses out living on lots of land, a totally essentially wild lifestyle. And they're checked on every day and they get vetting and hoof care, and that's it. Vetting and hoof care, are you all right? You're still alive? Full legs? Good. On you go. This is an old mare.
Yep.
And sent the mare there. Months later, checked in with them and said, oh, how's she going? My friend smiled and said, she has forgotten people ever existed, and she's thrilled about it.
Yeah, right?
She's thrilled about it. Now, her gelding would not have been happy in that system because he loves, but the mare was the right candidate. It's an example of how this can work.
Yes, and all horses are not the same, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I love this conversation. I love that we've had it. I hope it opens some some minds and hearts to just being able to play. Let's have a playful spirit about it right now, because we can. We have that liberty to be playful about it, but also serious, right? Also
playful
realize
and serious.
Playful
That's
and serious.
Not mutually exclusive, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to give our listeners one challenge today. My challenge to you is, at some point today, I'd like you to text, call, or email a horse buddy of yours, even distant, and say, hey, dude, mate, friend, if I died, would you make sure the horses are okay? If I left some money on the table, there's an envelope on the hallway table. It'll cover them for 6 months. If I did that, would you step in and make sure? Yes, no. Great. Thanks so much. Love you. That's all it has to be right now for many of us. Or just making sure that that's there. Or, you know, speaking to your farmer about next year's harvest. What do you anticipate? For example, doing something to plan for your future, you know?
Yep.
That's what I recommend everyone do today. Pick up your phone. Call, text, or email someone somewhere and make one move, just one easy move in the direction of creating a safety net for your horses, should there be a problem. That's my challenge for everyone today.
Can I add one thing to that?
Yeah, go on.
Only because for some people that can be a lot of pressure. And like if they don't have the financial resources to say, I'll leave money on the table, I know that for a lot of people that can feel like, oh my God, I'm failing again, right? Anyway, there's a lot of ways we fail horses in the world now. But even just reaching out to a friend to say, even a friend who's in the same boat, and say, this is a problem. We don't have a safety net for our horses. What can we do? What are some ideas? Let's make it a point to say we're going to try to figure something out together. Right? That don't get stuck in that there are no other solutions, and there are lots of other solutions.
Yeah. If you don't have 6 months to put cash on the table, do you have a week? Could you pay for the horses for a week?
Right.
If someone has horses and can't pay for them for a week, my brother and sister in Christ, why have you still got them? I mean, real talk. That's tough.
And there are lots of reasons why we might end up in that situation, but they're all examples of a system failing. And so
let's acknowledge
the system.
The system, not the individual, the system.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, love it. Kim, if people want to engage with you and work with you, you are ahead of your time, you're ahead of the curve, you've got your eye on the horizon always, and you never lose touch with what people are actually dealing with today or yesterday. Where can people find you, work with you, speak with you, get your support and assistance?
Best and easiest way is to just go to my website, which is my name, kimhallin.com. From there, you can find other ways to reach me, but I'm on social media as well. My name, or Unbridled LLC, is my business. I am on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I'm not on a lot of the other social media platforms, but you can also find me on LinkedIn or YouTube, any of those places.
Great. Thank you, Kim, for this conversation. I really enjoyed it. Have a great rest of your day, okay?
You too. All right, you too.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
If you would like to support this podcast, a simple way to do that is by leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon. It will help more people to find these conversations, and it would mean a lot to me. Horse First with Lockie Phillips is distributed by the Bleave Audio and Video Network. And just a gentle reminder, the content of this show is for informational and entertainment purposes only. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and are not a substitute for professional, veterinary, or medical advice. I'm Lockie Phillips. Thank you for being here.